one.
This is Paul Hurt and Jen Sweeney of Arizona State University interviewing Paul Grams at the Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center in Flagstaff, Arizona on January 24th, 2020. Thank you for joining us today, Paul.
Happy to be here.
Start out by telling us your name and spell it for us, please, and who you work for and the years that you've been involved in Grand Canyon research.
Well, my name is Paul Grams, P-A-U-L-G-R-A-M-S. I've been working at USGS here at GCOMRC. I started 12 years now. I started in January 2008, just a couple months before the 2008 high flow experiment, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. But my involvement actually dates back to January of 1991 when I went on a wintertime river trip as an undergraduate student.
With which professors and to do what kind of research?
That was, that was a wintertime trip. I was an undergraduate at Middlebury College in Vermont. I had already taken one geomorphology class from Jack Schmidt. And he offered, this was the second time he did it. He was a professor at Middlebury at the time. And he offered a winter term. Middlebury was on a kind of winter term schedule where they had a January term that students could just do one class. And so he offered a January term class that was essentially a Colorado River trip studying, the issues on river management and connected with studying the issues on river management in Grand Canyon. And so I took that as I guess I was a junior or a senior, I can't quite remember.
How did your career as a researcher evolve from that original trip? I assume you fell in love with the Grand Canyon.
Well, it was a great trip. There was about 12 students, Jack, a river guide named Tom Moody, who was very instrumental in the early part of the program, and a couple other friends of Jack's on the trip, and we did a 21, 22-day trip, which is a very long trip, with a motor rig, which means, lots of time camping, lots of time to do hikes. It was a great experience, and we got to see a lot of sights on that trip. And then after that trip, I went on and did a undergraduate thesis, working with Jack as my advisor, studying sediment-related issues on the Snake River in Hell's Canyon. So that was really the start of that trip. Kind of set me on the course towards studying rivers and especially studying rivers downstream from dams, and was the beginning of what is that? Getting close to a 30-year working relationship with Jack on studying rivers. And so working with him still today on both the Colorado River and throughout the basin.
So you have both a master's and a PhD. You specialized in river geomorphology. You want to talk a little bit about the research that you continued to do as you went after those advanced degrees?
I did an undergraduate degree in geology, and again, I did a master's thesis on looking at sandbars. That river trip we did in Grand Canyon, we surveyed a few sandbars that Jack had studied. Jack did his dissertation research in Grand Canyon in the 1980s, and so this wasn't too long after that. And so we went back to his study sites, surveyed a few sandbars, but he was at that time, thinking more broadly than Grand Canyon, and we got some people interested in studying sandbars on the Snake River in Hell's Canyon. So I did a little part of that as a undergraduate thesis. And the Hell's Canyon is a place where, in Grand Canyon we have the sediment-rich tributaries below the dam that we can talk about more, but that supply a lot of sediment that make it possible to sustain the sandbars in Grand Canyon, whereas on the Snake River there's very little tributaries downstream, so it was a case where there was extreme sandbar erosion caused by the upstream dam, and so we documented that. And today, it was kind of a very low profile study at the time, but there are still people up at managing Hell's Canyon Dam who refer back to that work and are dealing with, you know, the effects of Hell's Canyon Dam on the sandbars downstream. Mm-hmm. But then after that, I took a year or two off and then was living in Utah, and Jack by that time had moved from Vermont to Utah State University, and he and kind of his interest in looking at other river systems or other parts of the Colorado River Basin had gotten a project with the National Park Service to look at how Flaming Gorge Dam had affected the Green River in Dinosaur National Monument. And so he offered that to me as a master's thesis project. So I spent 3 years or so working on that project, and that was essentially involved looking at how the dam operations, the building of Flaming Gorge Dam had changed the downstream river system, first in Dinosaur, and then we expanded it a little bit to include the whole river from Flaming Gorge Dam down through to the Vernal, Utah area.
Beautiful country.
So finished that up, and wasn't quite sure what I was going to do next, but continued working on rivers with Jack and at Utah State for a couple of years as sort of a research associate, then decided I wanted to go ahead and do pursue a PhD. And I got in touch with a professor at Johns Hopkins named Peter Wilcock, who is somebody I'd met a few times and was a colleague of Jack's, and decided to go work with him to do something just a little bit different, and did something that was more of less of a field-based study and more of a modeling and laboratory-based study. So I did experiments in a laboratory flume and modeling work. But that was related to Grand Canyon. It was with partially funded by the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program, and it was looking at controls on sand entrainment and sand transport in course-bedded river systems, but with laboratory experiments.
Can you explain the word entrainment?
Oh, the picking up of sand from the bed of the river by the water. So the process by which water is picking up the sand and carrying it in suspension. And so...
So you did your PhD doing research again on sediment transport, essentially.
Essentially sediment transport, yeah.
In Grand Canyon. And when you finished that PhD, is that when you got hired here at Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center?
Not immediately, although I just did a couple-year postdoc position at Utah State University. So the PhD was at Johns Hopkins, then moved back to Utah where I lived for a long time, did a couple years there on a postdoc working on looking at streams, mountain streams in the forest for the Forest Service related project. But then this job came up and took that.
All right. And this job is what? Tell us a little bit more about what you do here.
I was hired, now this is a bit of the program and evolution of GCMRC, I was hired as a program manager, which was the physical science program manager position in 2008. And at that time, the structure of GCMRC was a little bit different than it is now. At that time, we were structured a little bit more as with managers of a few different programs. There's been some evolution in terms of how GCMRC has functioned since it was started. There was, I think, some uncertainty or even an idea that GCMRC might be a very small organization and most of the work would be contracted out or done through cooperative agreements with universities, and GCMRC would be a small number of managers that manage those contracts. Mm-hmm. And I was hired at a point where it was maybe in between that, where there was quite a bit of work done in-house, because you know, there's things that are ongoing, so the idea of always contracting out, I think, kind of immediately became problematic. But at any rate, I was hired as one of those program managers and did that job for a couple of years. And in that capacity, I managed the sediment monitoring program that's continuing now, and the sandbar monitoring program. But more as a manager, and then after a couple of years, and this is Jack Schmidt comes into the story again here, he was hired as chief in 2011? I don't remember the year. But he was hired as the chief, and he felt that we should have more of a research focus in-house, and he made it possible for me to transition my position from quote-unquote program manager into a research scientist. So my title now is a research hydrologist. And so instead of sort of broadly overseeing programs, I manage a couple research projects. So it's a somewhat of a semantic difference, but it is a real difference in terms of how the work gets done here. Because instead of just managing projects, so David Topping, who's sort of my colleague, co-equal, he manages the suspended sediment transport monitoring and measuring program. And I was nominally overseeing that as a program manager. Well, now he's just managing his project. And then I have the sandbar project that I just manage and work on as a researcher, not just as a manager.
So you work for the U.S. Geological Survey here at GCMRC. But much of the work that you're doing goes to inform decision-making for the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program. Can you talk a little bit about how you see your role as a researcher at GCMRC in the larger environment of the Adaptive Management Program? What's your role in the Adaptive Management Program?
Well, I mean, I think simply our role, as I think as people generally call it, is to be the science provider, the information provider. So, I do see it as giving them the information they seek to make management decisions, and also, I think a big part of the role is, because they do this as non-specialists, at least, or most of them non-science. I mean, a lot of them have science backgrounds, but some of them don't. And if they do have a science background, it could be in any area. So a big part of our role is educators on the science we do and on how the system works, and connecting that with whatever resource or whether it's a biological resource, a species of fish, or whether it's the sediment or the sandbars themselves, how those are related to the work we do, or how they are changing, or how they are being affected by the dam operations or other factors that might cause changes in those resources.
So is your research agenda, your personal one and GCMRC's larger constellation of research, is it partly directed by questions and problems that the Adaptive Management Program participants pose to you? Can they come to you and say, we need to know more about X so we can make a decision about Y? Is that...
Yeah, and it happens on, with the program that's gone on for so long. I mean, they'd have some general goals. Sometimes it'd be nice if the goals could be more specific, but that's difficult in the political and in the context. But so for sediment, they have a goal that's something like to maintain or increase sediment throughout the Colorado River and Grand Canyon for recreational, cultural, and biological or ecological purposes.
Mm-hmm. And so that's recovering sediment that has been lost since the dam was put in, right?
That would be, I think that would be up to interpretation and reading that. I mean, the goal is really, they've spent quite a bit of time, and it's to maintain or increase. So when it comes to saying, do we want to bring back to a restoring to a pre-dam condition, that's something that they would, that different stakeholders might mm-hmm. have different opinions about. What we try to do in those situations is tell them, okay, here's what it used to look like. Here's what we have relative to a pre-dam condition. It's up to them to decide whether that's the goal or not. Mm-hmm. They have not declared that. I mean, having a pre-dam condition as a goal would be pretty difficult to achieve, and they haven't set that goal specifically.
So some of your work, I'm at a university, and there's academic freedom in a sense where I could choose to research anything I wanted to research as long as I could find some financial support. Are you sort of in between that, where you can choose some of your own research projects and generate the science that you think is valuable, but also you're responsible for helping develop a knowledge base to support decision making in the adaptive management program? Are you juggling those two together?
We do juggle those. I mean, we are free to do research on any, just like an academic. If we can bring in funding for other research, we are free to work on that. And so we do have, some of us don't. Some of us at GCMRC work only in Grand Canyon, and some have a few other outside projects. I have a couple other non-Grand Canyon projects that funding comes in for, and I work on separately from Grand Canyon. So we are free to do that as scientists. Within Grand Canyon, if we're using, our adaptive management program funding, we try to keep it to things that are tied to the program and are directly relevant. We have a work plan process where we do that. So within that, if maintain some level of, there are certain things that, we monitor sandbars in the same way every year, and we've done it for 30 years. That doesn't create a high impact journal article publication each year because it's kind of an ongoing data series of the same thing. So when it comes to maybe adding a little bit of innovative science to that, we try to bring in new technology at times. So evaluate different methods to monitor what is of interest to the stakeholders, but doing it in new ways. We've evaluated use of, the sandbar surveys that we do were started by the group at Northern Arizona University in the early 1990s, and using methods at the time, and those have evolved a little bit, traditional survey methods. So we've explored bringing in more modern or new technology and things like that. So that's some of the ways we are doing the work for the adaptive management program, but also keeping it current and scientifically relevant.
Mm-hmm. Great. So one last question about the relationship between GCMRC and the adaptive management program, and then I want to drill down into the science of sedimentation a little bit more. What is your sense of what the relationship is? And I know it's changed over time. You've only been here since 2008, but how do you see that relationship besides you're a science provider? Is there anything more you can say about that?
I think it's beyond being the science provider, I think it's a source of stability for the program. There are stakeholders that have been around for a long time, and there are new stakeholders. And so it kind of comes back to that education side of it. I mean, that's one thing I try to keep in mind now. I think when I started 12 years ago, a majority of the stakeholders were people who had been involved in the program since the beginning. And so maybe the education aspect wasn't quite the same then. But we're in a stage now where a lot of the original stakeholders, there's a lot of turnover, people retiring, new people coming in. So I think providing that kind of continuity and education to make it possible for new stakeholders or ones that are less familiar and probably have less time to actually come up to speed. We now have, if you added up the publications and the amount of literature and what's been written and not written or is in gray literature on the Colorado River and Grand Canyon, there's nobody that could get through that in 10 years, let alone, if they're just starting out as a new stakeholder. It's kind of overwhelming. So I think distilling what's, important within each area that we work in for them is, I think, one important thing we provide.
Are there specific documents in which you do that distillation?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, we do our work plan is on a 3-year cycle. So each time we write a work plan that has some of that in it, I don't know if I can say that's if we write those intentionally with as a kind of a broad overview, but those are provided in that in our reports. But no, I think it happens when we interact with them mostly at meetings and give our presentations on our project updates that we try to do that kind of a thing.
I bring that up because a little bit later I'm going to ask you a question about key reports or documents that should be preserved for the historical record that provide sort of summaries of important developments or important research. And so keep that in the back of your mind and we'll come back to it a little bit later. So what have we learned about sediment and the Grand Canyon and the role of the dam in shaping, you know, that sediment transport and sediment load and sediment deposition since 1991 when you were first down there?
Oh boy, since 1991, there's been a lot since 1991. At that period, it was just when there was the push to really constrain dam operations from extreme fluctuations on a daily basis. So from the 1960s up until 1990-91, the dam was operated primarily for hydropower generation. So daily fluctuations from lows of around 5,000 cubic feet per second to highs of around 30,000 cubic feet per second on a daily basis. That's probably the extreme range, but I think it typically fluctuated from around 5 or 6 up to 25,000 CFS, which is very high. A pre-dam average flood was around 85 or 90,000 cubic feet per second. So that's fluctuating from essentially not turning the river off, but turning it way down low to a third of an annual flood each day. And so that was a source of a mechanism of sand erosion. I mean, the sand bar deposits are inherently unstable, but the dam did two things. It blocked all upstream sediment from the whole Colorado River Basin from entering Grand Canyon, and then it changed the flow regime. And so those two things resulted in erosion with the clear water, high fluctuating flows, but then the lack of replenishment because the upper basin sediment delivery was gone. So those two things contribute to a big decline in sandbars. And in the 90s, that was the point at which they had seen that. They had seen the potential there was unintentional floods that occurred in 1983 and 84. And they saw, wow, even in a system that's been so impacted, the sandbars could recover because those floods did build sandbars on the banks of the river, and they saw that. And then they saw that they were eroding again. And so I think that sparked the idea with the senior sediment scientists at the time, Jack Schmidt, Ned Andrews, Bob Webb, I'm sure others, Tim Randall at the Bureau of Reclamation, I think, was involved. I was an undergraduate student, so I was sitting at the outside ring of the campfire when they were having those discussions on that river trip in 1991 about, well, what would happen if we did an intentional flood release from the dam? Would that do the same thing as those floods in the 1980s? And so I think that was a big turning point, was just the idea and the follow-through that happened at that time to give it a try with that first experimental flood that they did in 1996. So I think that idea came about, and I'm sure if you need to check with some of those guys on when exactly they came up with the idea, but it was around that time. And then it took a few years for it to gain traction and to get the political will to do it behind it. But by the time that happened in 1996, that was a big turning point then. And that provided the demonstration that, yes, you could use the dam to raise the river to build sandbars. Because the real problem with the situation of the sandbars are those two things, the lack of a flood to build them, and then you need the supply to do it. So there's just, it's a pretty simple process. We just need two things. You need the water to move the sand around, but then you need the sand there to begin with. And those are the two things we study, is what what the floods do, what the flows do to building the bars, but then is there enough supply of the sand such that those floods can actually do it? Because if there isn't enough supply, then the floods will eventually cause net erosion. There's enough background storage that you could do a few of these floods and expect them to build sandbars. It's kind of like a deficit spending situation. Are you using that last bit in your bank account to build some sandbars and then going to run out, or do you have a auto deposit system going that's putting sand back in? So
now you mentioned when Glen Canyon Dam went in, it cut off the flow of sediment from all of the upstream tributaries. There's still a few downstream tributaries below Glen Canyon Dam, not too many. Would you explain what and where they are, and a little bit about how you monitor those to determine when a high flow experiment is appropriate?
Yeah, those are critical, and that is what makes it possible to do this in Grand Canyon, to manage the system for both the hydropower interests and for sandbars and for recreational interests, is that we have tributaries that do supply a lot of sediment. And the first of those is the Pereira River. It drains a big portion of southern Utah. It comes into the Colorado River just at Lee's Ferry, about 15 miles downstream from Glen Canyon Dam. So really relatively soon, near downstream from the dam, is a tributary that supplies a lot of sediment. Not a lot in context to what the pre-dam average loads were, something on the order of maybe 5-ish percent of what would have gone by Lee's Ferry without the dam is what the Pereira delivers on average. But because it's just one tributary, you're dealing with, you know, and the sediment delivery events are triggered by very unpredictable summer monsoon type thunderstorm events. So when that sediment comes in, it's predictable in the sense that it happens in the late summer, early fall, sometime July through September each year. But you have years when nothing happens, and which occurred last year. And then you have years that you get a lot of monsoonal activity and a lot of thunderstorms and a lot of sediment delivery. But that's the source of sediment, the source of resupply, the replenishment of the bank account, the sediment bank account, that allows us to use flood releases from the dam to rebuild sandbars. And the way we do it is by measuring the stream flow and sediment concentrations on the Pereira River. So it's a river that almost dries up. It's usually got a little bit of a trickle of water in it, but when a flood happens, and we know when a flood's happening simply by watching the weather, or we have upstream gauges that tell us when a flood's coming downstream. But when we know a flood's coming downstream, a team of hydrologists from this office get in their trucks and drive out to Lee's Ferry and start sampling. And they measure the flow and the sediment concentrations, and then we start analyzing those data and calculating how much sediment is coming in from the Pereira River. And we do that every year. And then this process is written up into a protocol that is a document produced by the Bureau of Reclamation for how the controlled floods will be designed. And so we monitor those sediment inputs, and once we've gotten a few, the data get published. I actually go to our website, but they also go to the Bureau of Reclamation, and then they use those data in a model that predicts, given that amount of sediment, what will happen to that sediment with or without a high flow. The idea here is, and it is all, I think the bank account analogy is the correct one, because what we're trying to do is keep the sediment bank account in Marble Canyon, which is the reach of the river between Lee's Ferry and 60 miles downstream where the next major tributary comes in, and I can talk about that more in a minute, but we're focused mainly on the Pria River. We try to keep the sediment bank account in that reach on an annual basis to be balanced, to so that what goes in is about the same as what goes out. And what goes in is the sediment from the Pria River, and what goes out is what the Colorado River transport out downstream, 60 miles downstream from where the Pria River comes in. And we measure that as well. We have a measurement program that measures that. But we also have models that can predict how much will go out at the downstream end. And so once we have some data on how much sediment has come in from the Pria River, so maybe the Pria River has some storms in August, and we get some data on that by the end of August and early September, we give that data to the Bureau of Reclamation, and they run this model and say, okay, we've had 500,000 tons of sand come in from the Pria River. If we do normal dam operations, no flood, about 100,000 tons of that sand will go out. That means there's 400,000 tons left in the bank account to work with. So then they rerun the model, putting in a flood. And they put in a flood, and the protocol that they've written allows for a flood to be up to 60 or 96 hours, I can't remember. One of those two, a certain duration at the capacity of the power plant plus the bypass tube. So that gets us to about 44 to 45,000 cubic feet per second flow rate that they could release from the dam for a flood. So they run a model with that flood, 45,000 CFS for 60 hours, and then see what happens to the bank account of sediment. And if that causes all the sediment to go out and drive it negative, they decide that flood's too big, and they rerun the model with a smaller flood. But if that model predicts, gee, you can run that big flood and the balance is at zero or above, they say, well, that's it, we can do it. And then that's what they schedule for the fall.
So there's a high flow experimental flood each fall, if depending on whether the sediment is there for it?
Exactly. Just following that step-by-step process, if there's enough sediment from the Pria that you can run a flood but keep your Marble Canyon sand bank account balance above zero, you can do it. If it drives it negative, you reduce the size of that flood to a minimum of, I think, 24 hours and at power plant capacity. So they run this model iteratively with progressively smaller floods to find the one that fits. And if nothing fits, then they don't do one at all. And that's what happened last year, that the sediment inputs were so low that I don't even know if they bothered. They probably ran the model, but the balance was already negative without even having a flood. So, and that's what happens if you don't have any Pria sediment inputs.
So do you think, before you turn to the Little Colorado River, because I know that's your next example, do you think that those models are working, or are they constantly having to be updated because what you expect to happen based on the modeling doesn't happen? I mean, how close to predicting, you know, the outcome that you want are the models working?
The model that this is this main model is a model written by Scott Wright, who worked. He's still a USGS employee, but he worked at GCMRC up until just before I left. Now he's with the California Water Science Center, and by Scott and Dave Topping, who's still here, and it's. It's a model for predicting sand transport in the river based on the sediment supply conditions and flow rate, and it works pretty well. And so when we test the model performance in this scenario, the predictive mode, but then we can, after we've actually done the flood and everything, we can compare the measurements, the field data, and do an after-the-fact assessment of how the model performed predicted relative to what actually happened. And when we've done those comparisons, the model predictions tend to be off by a little bit, but on the order of 10, 15, 20% or something, which with the objectives of this, you know, the model isn't designed and doesn't predict what happens to each individual sandbar. It's not designed to do that, and it doesn't do that. But what it does do is predict this predict what's going to happen to the sediment bank account. And it does that closely enough that we can use it as this management tool. So, and I think it's a good example of where the science really has produced something for the managers at a useful scale. I mean, people at the same time have spent quite a bit of effort trying to do much more precise and finely resolved models that maybe would predict what every sandbar does. But those never got finished because they're very complicated, very finicky, and difficult. And require a lot of input data and constant evaluation. Whereas this model is pretty robust, quite simple, and it does what the managers really need, which is a tool to tell them, you know, whether or not to do a flood and about how big it should be. And if it's off by a few percent, it doesn't matter that much. And it looks like it's been off in the realm where they tend to be a little more conservative, which is good. That the models predicted maybe a little more erosion that has ended than what has ended up happening. So our sediment balance ends up being a little bit positive.
Which is better.
So it's erring on the side of holding back a little bit.
So the second tributary that contributes sediment?
Is the Little Colorado River. And that is about 60 miles downstream from Lee's Ferry. At the time, and that's something we're learning a lot about right now. And a couple of my colleagues here have recently completed a study of the Little Colorado River Basin to better understand what's gone on in that river basin. But it was considered to be about equal in the amount of sediment delivery to the Paria River. It's looking like recently the amount of sediment contributed by the Little Colorado River has declined, is less, and it's also less predictable. It's a little bit, the monsoon storms, although they happen in the Little Colorado River Basin, a lot of those storms don't necessarily all make it down to the mouth, delivering sediment to the Colorado River. And so as a supplier of sediment, it's a little less reliable now than the upstream Paria River is. And because of its location further downstream, we've focused management on the Paria River and the upstream reach because it's the reach in the greatest amount of sediment deficit. And because the system's large, it's also a bit of, okay, we need to confine the problem a little bit to make it manageable. And that's been sort of the manageable thing, is to tackle, to run the protocol around the Paria River and Marble Canyon, and then we monitor the effects for the whole system. So there's a bit of manage it for the upstream segment, and then monitoring downstream, hoping that it performs well down there too.
So when we have a high flow event, you get both erosion and deposition, depending on what kind of flow there is, how much sediment there is, where, you know, which beach we're talking about, which reach. And your goal, as I understand it then, in designing these HFEs, high flow experiments, is to maximize the deposition, to do beach building flows, as they used to be called, and minimize beach erosion, because you're trying to build sediment on the shore, on the beaches. There's a number of the people that we've interviewed have suggested that the HFEs are not working and there's as much erosion or more than sediment. I think it's probably changed over time, and you're the expert who can probably answer that question for us. Have you gotten better at being able to figure out how to make the HFEs deposit more than they erode?
Well, we can't control what they do. you open the dam, but what the reality is, I mean, the HFE, every time we've done one, they have resulted in more deposition of sandbars than erosion. So the HFEs themselves do cause sandbar deposition.
In the upper reach, I assume you're talking about.
The whole river.
Whole river.
And we've seen this now. We've done enough of them that There may be sites that get smaller, but by and large, probably two-thirds of the sites we monitor at least get larger with each HFE. A few get smaller, but that would be a pretty small percentage, and a few don't change much. But most of them get bigger. I think what a lot of people see, and what we, you know, honestly do have to, we do tell them, is that a lot of these, the bars then begin eroding again immediately, or within several months. So that by the time you're maybe a year later, a lot of the sites are back to where they started. And so that is really part of the process. I mean, these are unstable sandbars in a river with fluctuating flows, in a river that's constantly changing. In the pre-dam system, the bars weren't stable. They would be, the river would deposit huge sandbars and they'd erode. I think in some sense, the objective is for the bars to erode. If you didn't intend for the bars to erode, there's no point in building them. I mean, it's a dynamic system, and the erosion is part of the process that I think we should be managing for. Because without the erosion, then they become locked in and stable. And so one of the other issues that's going on, you probably talked to people about, is the vegetation encroachment. Well, some of these bars that are the most active, which means that they get big and then they erode, those are bars where the vegetation hasn't become established and can be large sandbars. And so another way to look at it is, by doing the HFEs, we have bars that are larger for a good fraction of the year than they would be without the HFEs. So they don't immediately erode to nothing. They're there for people to use for a good chunk of the year. And that we have to recognize that we're managing for a dynamic system and not a static, like the bars are perfect and they will be this way all the time.
That's an excellent explanation. I appreciate that. Yeah, we had a recent interview with somebody who was suggesting that the beaches haven't changed that much, and once you create a beach, it'll be there for 100 years. And that was different than anything I'd ever heard from anybody else before. Does the research support that assertion or not?
Well, you know, the dam has helped with that. There are things that have been there for 100 years now because the dam doesn't, the flows don't get high enough to erode them. So, but we're not going to build those beaches either because the dam doesn't get high enough to build them.
You mean the floods don't get high enough?
Right, the floods released from the dam don't get high enough to build bars that would be up high. So there are portions of sandbars now that are completely overgrown with vegetation, locked in place, and will not change unless, you know, all hell breaks loose and we get snow all winter and they fill the reservoir and have to release, you know, floods like they did in the 1980s. But until that happens, there are things that won't change. So what we're managing with the HFEs are a portion of the sandbars that are dynamic, that do change.
Great.
And those, the ones that are static, that the HFEs don't affect, tend to be the ones that are stabilized by vegetation. And then there are the portions that are the active bars that the HFEs do rebuild. You know, one of the other things I point out when we're talking about what the HFEs do on the sandbars is that a lot of the places are affected by smaller scale processes like hill slope runoff that cuts gullies across the sandbars, even small tributaries that form and erode a big gully in some of the campsites and sandbars. And then the HFEs can come along and repair those gullies and fill it in and basically create a new sandbar that might not be all that much bigger than the bar was there before, but it's been essentially renovated.
One of the other complaints we've heard from people we've interviewed involve the fact that the HFEs are bringing a lot of sediment from the riverbed itself farther to down to the lower river, and where it gets close to Lake Mead and the flow is slower, it drops that sediment. And so places like Diamond Creek, where the Hualapai tribe has a river running operation, they're talking about sediment, you know, making it difficult for their business operations.
Right.
Is there truth to the argument that the HFEs are causing problems for people in the lower river, and what might be done about that?
Well, we could, I mean, that, so I think what's going on with that is that they are in the part of the river, this is essentially the part of the river that has sometimes been underwater in Lake Mead. So it's the transition from the Colorado River to Lake Mead. So it's the segment of the canyon that has the opposite problem from most of Grand Canyon. Most of Grand Canyon is in sediment deficit because, as I said, the dam blocks 90% of what was entered before the dam was built. And so it's a condition of lack of sediment. Well, the sediment that we do have is going downstream, and all of it goes to Lake Mead. And so they're in the realm, the zone of sediment deficit. That area is essentially a river delta, so it's in a grading system, and all the flows transport the sediment downstream. One thing we've seen when we look at the years with and without HFEs, it doesn't really matter whether or not we do an HFE. An HFE doesn't really affect the total amount of sediment that goes past, say, Diamond Creek, which is our downstream gauging station, which is, 225 miles downstream from Lee's Ferry, about 30, 40 miles upstream from the reach of maybe sediment accumulation that the Hualapai are concerned about. But about the same amount of sediment goes past that point whether or not we do an HFE, because what the HFE does, it doesn't really change the total amount of sediment that gets carried downstream. It changes the timing of when that occurs, because the Parias deliver a lot of sediment. It's relatively fine. It accumulates on the bed of the river, and then we do an HFE, and that picks up the sediment and deposits in sandbars and moves some downstream. And it also coarsens the bed of the river at the same time. So as that sediment is picked up in the high flows, they coarsen the bed of the river. So then after an HFE, you get relatively lower transport rates than before. If you don't do an HFE, you've still got all that fine sediment there, but then we go into the winter season of high power plant operations to generate electricity. And so those high fluctuating flows, instead, they transport the sand downstream. So whether we do an HFE to move the sand or do high power plant operations in the winter, the sand's going to go downstream, and it's going to go to Lake Mead either way. So it's not so much a question of the volume that's going into this reach where they're having the navigation issues. It's the timing and the flows that cause its redistribution. And so it doesn't mean that they don't have that there isn't a problem there, and the HFEs could have a role in determining the relative distribution of that sediment. Mm-hmm. It's possible that the HFEs make it better than it would be without the HFEs. It could be even worse, and so that is something we haven't studied in detail down there, but is something that I actually proposed a project in the last work plan to work on this issue, but the budgets were tight and that one didn't quite get through. We'll put it again this time. But the idea there would be to look at how the sediment in that reach, how the distribution of the sediment is affected by different dam operations. There is a problem there because it is going to be a zone of sediment accumulation. Just like the upstream reach is a zone of deficit no matter what we do, there is a zone of sediment accumulation no matter what we do. And it's not just affected by dam operations. It's also affected by the fact that it's cutting down into the former Lake Mead Delta. You know, the Lake Mead has now dropped a lot, and so the river is incising into the the accumulation of sediment. So, yeah, it's a difficult problem in terms of how to, whether or not it's even possible to find an operation scenario that would help create them, improve their navigation channel is really what it's about. It's tricky, you know. Yeah. These are the things that engineers deal with on the big rivers where they're trying to get barges upstream and downstream. But they end up doing things like building wing dikes and groins and things that concentrate the stream flow into the center of a river channel. But those are big engineering works. But those are the kinds of things that are done to deal with those problems.
I did a river trip through Grand Canyon last year, my very first one last summer. We went all the way to, was that Hayden Ferry or some
Pierce Ferry?
Pierce Ferry, right. And it was rather eerie floating through that stretch below Diamond Creek and above Pierce Ferry, where you're incised down in the river beneath these giant plateaus of sediment that are constantly falling into the river. And there was at one point when we were floating through this stretch of river and the plateau of sediment was probably a couple of hundred feet high, and a gust of wind set off a collapse of a piece of it, and more and more. It's like an avalanche of snow on a steep mountain slope. It just came pouring down and hit the water and sent a blast of dusty water and wind across the river right into one of our boats. It was dangerous.
And you saw that, you were there on one trip in 1 year and saw that.
Right.
And when I've been down there, I've seen that. So that's something that is happening constantly. And so it's entirely possible that the amount of sediment falling into the river off of those high cut banks from the form, that was the bed of
Lake Mead. Right.
Is an equal contributor to the navigation problem down there.
Yeah, we actually got stuck at one point. We couldn't figure out which way to get around. There was a very wide river and a big sandbar, and we didn't know whether to go left or right. We took the wrong path, and we had to drag our raft.
And that's the problem that they're talking about. So it's a legitimate, it's a serious problem that they have. It's not going to be an easy solution.
Yeah. So were you part of the effort to create that phenomenal website that USGS has that shows before and after pictures from the high flow experiments? There's a website that USGS has. Did you help to develop that, and can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, thanks. that's our website. I can't take credit for doing the technical side, but that's my project in terms of the collecting those images and making it happen, getting them on there. That's what, one of the things that my project does. And so where that came about was actually when I first started, there's a long history of using cameras at our monitoring sites. That goes back to the early days when they were first studying these sites in the 1990s. The scientists at the time recognized pretty quickly that they were collecting data. You know, even if they were doing trips a couple, you know, there were years when they were doing several river trips a few months apart. But even with that level of frequency visiting monitoring sites, they recognized a lot was happening when they weren't there. And so they put up, at that time, it was analog old film cameras,
right.
just handheld small little point and shoot film cameras that had a intervalometer that they could put on them. That would, I think the most they could do was set the intervalometer to take a picture every 24 hours, set it up they put it in a little ammo can with a window and hit go. Whatever time they did it was when it took the first picture, and then 24 hours thereafter till the roll of film was gone, so they'd at least get something. They'd get 24 days, or if they had 36 days worth of images from a site, and they kept those going on and off from in the 1990s and 2000s, and then by when I started in 2008, a colleague in a different USGS branch here had developed a digital system, and we started putting those in 2008 for the 2008 high flow experiment, and they worked great. We're very reliable, so we decided to put them at every all of our monitoring sites. So it,
and you get hundreds and hundreds of pictures.
Yep. So between 2008 and 2012 is when we expanded to getting one at every one of our sites, and we program them to take. Actually, where they're taking 5 pictures a day because we want to get. Because memory card space now is cheap, so why not take enough pictures? And then by doing that, we get a range of flows and lighting conditions. So then we can pick from the photos it takes which ones have the best combination of river flow level and lighting. And then we pick from those some and put on the website for seeing what the HFEs do.
Our younger readers are probably going to want to know what we mean by roll of film.
Yeah.
How could somebody find that? What's the easiest way for somebody to find that website? Because it really is remarkable. You can look at these different beaches and you get a picture before the high flow experiment and then during and then after, and really see how those flows alter the morphology of the river.
Ben. Yeah, just on our website, www.gcmrc.gov/sandbar.
/sandbar, okay.
It's a redirect now. I don't think that's the actual site. They've changed, the government has kicked us around a bit in terms of how our websites are set up, but that still works.
Yeah, I'd like to get a permanent link for that to link to our website, because that's something that I dreamed of doing, because I love reef photography. Most interesting ways of documenting change over time is reef photography. My colleague at ASU, Mark Klett, did some of the best and most interesting reef photography work on the Grand Canyon decades ago. And when I saw what you guys had done, I thought, okay, well, I don't have to do that now. It's really a remarkable resource. So thank you for putting
that
together.
Yeah, and thanks for that. And we also, in addition to just those paired or the time series photos at each site, we also have a site, kind of a collaborative effort with the Grand Canyon River Guides Association. So they started a program back, I think they started it with the 1996 controlled flood, and they call it the Adopt a Beach Program. And this is where river guides volunteer to take a camera and take repeat pictures of their favorite campsite or beach, and they do it throughout a season. And then we also put those photos on a website. They're not like our remote cameras are fixed location, so they're perfect matches from one to the next.
Right.
These are more, you know, the guy picks a spot and takes a photo there and kind of approximates.
Next year that spot's underwater, so.
Yeah, but they show the same sites, and so that's also on our website to look at.
Great. All right, well, again, historians like to think about and evaluate change over time. And so that's what I want to turn to for a minute and ask you to reflect on how sediment research has changed over time. You've talked about what we do now and how we've perfected those processes to better predict outcomes. But can you give us a little historical sense, if you can, about, you know, the questions we were asking early on versus the questions we're asking today and what we've learned?
I think a lot of the questions are similar, but I think we've learned about, you know, like I said, the basics of the sandbar management on one level are pretty simple in the sense of it's needing the flows to build a sandbar, and then it's what's the supply condition. So a big part of the initial focus was guessing what the supply condition was. What we do now is we actually measure it, and we're setting ourselves up to actually know what the supply condition is. So it's kind of the scientists working on this, when we first started, they recognized what the most important thing was, and that is how much sand is there, and then what does it take to use it to build sandbars and keep it there. But what we do now is they had to rely on extremely sparse measurements and essentially very simple modeling prediction guesses of what the supply conditions were, and their predictions varied greatly from the sand's just accumulating on the bed of the river and we just need to run floods and we'll be fine, then going the opposite direction, saying, no, there's a downward spiral and there's almost no sand left and the system is about to be completely reamed out. And I think what we've learned now is that there's a potential, at least under the conditions we've seen. So by going from implementing this high flow protocol period where we do the repeat high flows, we got pretty lucky in the timing of things, and we'll see how luck carries us into the future. But the luck we had is that since 2012, when this started, we have had most years with good amounts of sand inputs from the Priya River, average or above, and we have had approximately average dam release volume. So those two things are the two key ingredients to what happens to the sand supply. You get, if dam release volumes are high, we get a lot of export. And that happened in 2011. But since 2011, the release volumes have been at about an average amount that has allowed sand to either be maintained in the system or accumulate. So what I think we've really learned is that, and now that we can actually measure the sand budget, and we measure it by our measurements of sand transport in the river, and we measure it by actually going out and mapping the bed of the river and then repeating that map of the bed of the river at a second point in time and looking at the difference and seeing how much has the bed of the river changed, and has the sand storage supply in the bed of the river changed. And so when 20, 30 years ago, they were kind of assuming or guessing what the sand storage would do when we had a flood or under different scenarios of annual volumes and tributary inputs, we're now in a position to actually measure what the bed of the river does and see how that plays out. And what we've seen is that it's in an approximate balance under these conditions. So I think there was a big, when you asked about major turning points, I mm-hmm. think, that 96 flood was, and what led up to it was one major turning point. I think the next one was the recognition and then the implementation of the idea of doing repeat high flows, which happened with the HFE protocol, which was implemented in 2012. So the idea that instead of these high flows being one-off experiments that we did once in a while, it was turned into an experiment that involved doing it repeatedly year after year. And they called it a HFE high flow experiment protocol. And so it's not, but the experiment isn't what each HFE does. The experiment is what happens if we do this for 10 or 20 years. And so that's what we're in the middle of. And at this point in it, what I think we're learning is that if the conditions are right, it basically works. But it's kind of a teeter-totter balance of, right now we're in this position where the inputs and the flow volumes have allowed it to work it almost exactly as intended, as designed. And so what the future holds is really, it's almost, you get different answers, and I think it's more of a almost a personal the answer you get might reflect more on that person's disposition than on any basis. And because somebody who tends to be a little bit of a pessimist will say, look, we're hinging this all on continued average inputs and above average inputs and average or below dam releases. Well, that's not likely, so the system is doomed, is one perspective, because how can we have above average inputs and below average dam releases? The flip side is, well, it's worked for close to 10 years now, and so maybe these are the average conditions that we're gonna have. That's kind of the big mystery is what will happen with, we've got expectations of what's the idea that flows will be average or below average might not be that ridiculous, because predictions for the basin are for low runoff with climate change. But what else scientifically is, let's see.
Is there anything else that we need to know? I mean, it was really interesting to hear you say at the very beginning when people started proposing these high flow events, experiments, they were guessing at what the results might be and didn't have the data to actually say, here's the likely outcome based on what we've measured before. So you had to spend years and years and years advocating for something that was a guess and then monitoring the outcomes to refine your predictions and models to the point where now you're saying, after maybe, I don't know, what is this, 20 years mm-hmm. of experiments, now you're saying the model is pretty robust. It has only about 15% error in it for the most part. It's been working well for 10 years, and we get the outcome we're looking for every time we do this because right. we've been able to refine what we know and how to manage these things. That's pretty great. So somebody might say, well, have we learned everything we need to learn?
Have we learned everything we need to learn?
Can we stop studying sediment now and move on to something else?
You know, it depends on what their objective is, mm-hmm. really. I mean, if we're comfortable with everything as they are and are confident in what the Paria River is going to do in the future or what the river flows would be, that might be an argument. What part of what the program is interested in is monitoring, you know, the results into the future.
Grand Canyon monitoring and research.
Yeah, so there's that aspect of it is keeping track of what the system is doing and continuing to verify that things are happening.
Are there any big questions or knowledge gaps in sediment flow that you wish we could throw some money at to understand better?
Well, there's probably the areas that we are working in on that are, you mentioned the issue of navigation downstream, so that's one area where there's a kind of a resource or a management problem or issue that they're interested in that we don't really understand or. And so that would be an area of research to do to learn something new about how the system's working that might be of interest. In terms of the sandbars themselves, one thing we've been looking at and are continuing to look at is interactions between the sandbars and vegetation. Mm. So the role that different vegetation types play in either essentially accelerating sandbar deposition or sandbar stabilization. So if they, and that could be applied towards management, if they want to start removing vegetation or changing the vegetation community in some way to improve the, or change the way the sandbars look or change how people can use the sandbars is one thing. The other thing that's come up that's of interest that would maybe be in the realm of fine-tuning how the HFEs work is whether we can, by using HFEs of different magnitudes, we can cause deposition to occur in different places. And that's or whether by changing the shape of the HFE hydrographs, if you go to our website and look at the HFE hydrographs, the flow releases from the dam, they all have a pretty similar shape where the water goes straight up. You know, they increase the releases very quickly. It's flat at the peak of the HFE, and then they turn it off, and it's essentially straight down. And so there's questions about whether if we had different rates of like down ramp rates, so mm-hmm. lowered the releases slower, could we have bars that had a different shape? So some of the river guides are interested in bars that might have a lower slope or something like that. What's another thing? The other thing that there is in terms of scientifically, there's quite a bit we could still understand about. There are, I think you mentioned earlier that, you know, the HFEs don't cause
every sandbar to respond the same. So there are some bars, there are some bars that are rowed with HFEs or under different conditions while some build. And we still don't understand exactly why that is for some sites. We know it has something to do with the channel conditions probably, or the hydraulics being different at different sites. Mm-hmm. And so scientifically, that's something we're looking at and trying to explain why some eddies, some sandbar areas, some eddies where the sandbars occur behave differently than others. And I think that can help with management. I think it's at a finer level than just, okay, we've got the HFE protocol that generally builds sandbars. Now we're going to look at how we can optimize it or what we could do to improve, more broadly improve conditions. So those are some of the other things we're looking at. But when it comes to, we're going to be starting working on our, writing up our new next 3-year work plan in the next few months here. And so our project will, you know, we've got our regular sandbar monitoring, which is seeing what each HFE does and what the long-term trends are at the sandbar monitoring sites. And that involves surveying the sites and collecting those photos. So that is primarily a monitoring effort. And then we do these repeat maps of the riverbed, which is, you know, okay, over the long terms, are we maintaining the sand mass balance? And that is contributing to really determining whether or not what are the chances that they can keep doing this using the HFE protocol successfully, or whether they should be doing floods more frequently. You know, if sand's accumulating and things, it's possible to show, well, you actually have plenty of degrees of freedom here, and you could be doing floods more liberally. Or you should hold back because the sand is supply is diminishing, which means not just holding back on HFEs, but considering what other operations might be needed to maintain sand storage if that's what they want to do.
I'm glad you mentioned that riverbed mapping. That's one of the things that Jen and I found when looking at some of your previous published research. Could you talk briefly about how you map the, you know, subsurface of the water, the riverbed itself, which is, you know, several feet to 20 or 30 feet below the surface. You can't see it when you're floating down the river. You can't see the riverbed,
right,
for the most part. But we need to know how much sediment is down there and where it's deposited. And so you've helped to sort of innovate ways of mapping the sediment. And you said earlier in our interview that it's like 80% or more of the sediment in the river is underwater in the river channel.
Yeah, 80 to 90%. Of the sediment that's moved by the, mm-hmm. It takes the water to move it. So the sediment that the water is moving is underwater by definition. And so it's only that little bit between, you know, if you happen to be on the river when it's flowing at 10,000 cubic feet per second, it's only that bit between that where the river gets at 10,000 and up to maybe the high flow stage of 35 to 40,000. So there's that window there of where the sediment gets deposited by the high flows, but that's a small slice of the sand in the system. That yeah. Most of the sediment is in there's deep pools in the center of the channel, and then there's deep pools in the eddies, the big kind of
pools of sediment, you mean?
Yeah, big pools of sediment there, and so we map those. And people started doing it as soon as the technology became available using sonar. So we use sonar instruments. So those are acoustic instruments. They generate a ping, a pulse of sound that is generated by an instrument that's in the water that we hang off, you know, suspend from the front of the boat into the river. And it sends a ping down. That sound bounces off the bed of the river, comes back to the instrument, and the instrument knows when it sent it, and it measures the time it took for it to travel and calculates the distance and uses that to come up with measurements of depth. But the instruments are actually sophisticated enough that it doesn't send down one ping in one beam. It sends down up to, I think, around our instrument does 512 beams in a swath. So just by driving down the center of the channel, you can actually measure depth across a large portion of the riverbed as you're driving, so in kind of a swath as you drive down the channel. So we can drive these boats with these multi-beam sonar instruments up and down the channel in a section of river, and then make a topograph, essentially a topographic map, but it's a bathymetric map of the bed of the river.
And are those available on the web somewhere? Can somebody go and look at those maps?
Yeah. We have two different ways. We have the a map viewer on our website that kind of have to look around for it, but it's on the GCMRC website that has the one for, right now, I think the only one that's on there is from Lee's Ferry from the dam to Lee's Ferry, but that's something you can toggle around and view. And then we've got publications with you can download the maps for other segments of the river.
So that's an example of a critical resource that we didn't know anything about because we couldn't see it and hadn't measured it. And you came up with a proposal to fund a project to map that sediment, and now you're monitoring how it changes over time so that you can be in a better position to determine the effects of different flow levels.
Right.
Yes?
Yeah, no, that's the idea.
That's how science works.
That's how it works. And so back in when in the early period, they had a need for a stream flow model to predict just water surface elevations at different flows throughout the canyon. And so they did that by, they did a river trip in the 1980s where they measured a channel cross section every mile or two and used that to develop the stream flow model, which is very coarse. And then the rest of it, they had to interpolate between those cross sections and make up what the bed of the river looked like. But so now what we've done is collected enough data that they can do a model based on real measurements of what the riverbed is. So scientifically, that's another next step is developing models for stream flow based on our measured channel geometry.
Was the funding for that riverbed mapping, did it come from the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program, or was this some other grant or independent
research?
No,
it's all been from the Adaptive Management Program.
Do you have any sense of what percentage of the research that's funded here at GCMRC comes from the Adaptive Management Program? Is it a small fraction or a half or a majority? Any idea?
No, all of it.
All of your funds? Well, you said you have several other projects.
Oh, I have a couple other projects.
From other grants.
All of
that
them. But when you talk GCMRC, I'm thinking. I'd say, and the non-Grand Canyon work has been relatively recent and is only a few of us. For myself, it's, probably, I've had maybe a couple of years where it's been maybe, I've had maybe up to 25 or 30% non-Grand Canyon work.
Okay.
Now I'm back to probably more like 90% Grand Canyon work. So,
Grand Canyon work funded by
the Adaptive Management Program.
Okay.
And so, and there are most of the people here are 100% on the Adaptive Management Program.
Okay. So with that as a background.
As a center as a whole, it's probably on, 90, 95%.
Okay.
Adaptive Management Program.
That's very significant. So with that as a background, stepping back a little bit again, away from the specific research, how well do you think the effort to link the research done here at GCMRC with decision-making, policy decisions and dam operation decisions, that's the goal, is to have science to support decision-making. But sometimes it's difficult to make that connection. So just, tell us what you think about that process. How has it gone? Has it changed much over time? Is it fulfilling or frustrating?
From my perspective, I think it functions pretty well. We have a reasonable dialogue with the stakeholders. I think it does vary depending on who you talk to, and things have cycles. But from my perspective, the system, the setup, it depends on how you see the objectives, but I think there's probably a good balance. I don't know if anybody's perfectly happy with it, but I think most people feel that it's accomplishing what it was meant to. I think that I'm trying to think, you know, I mean, I'm pretty proud of how the sediment program has worked in the sense that we've been able to, and you know, this, a lot of these contributions came from the work that was done before I came here in terms of just setting up the idea of doing the high flows and the way we do the monitoring and have the monitoring set up. But I think it's a pretty good example of how both some basic science, but a lot of applied science has been directed directly towards management problems, and it's been used to guide it, and with quite a bit of back and forth in terms of doing experiments, and then scientists, you know, writing up publications on what happened, and then the managers doing something different. I mean, the response isn't always immediate. And it takes time. You know, doing the HFE protocol document. I mean, people started saying, well, we need to do high flows more frequently than just having, you know, every, what would it have been? You know, almost 8 years between them or something. And that discussion started immediately, was sort of going on when I started in 2008, and it took until 2012 for that to be implemented, but it did happen. And so I think there's frustration with, now that they've implemented the latest version of management, the long-term experiment and management plan, they call it the LTEMP, which sets the operating regime. I think, you know, one of the things that where the high flow protocol has a little bit of a, I don't know, problem, an issue right now, is that there's a kind of a growing interest in having high flows occur in the spring. And the high flow protocol is all about maximizing the use of the Priya River to do things in the fall, because the Priya River contributes sediment in the late summer. And it makes sense in terms of capitalizing on those Priya sand inputs to do the high flows in the fall. And that, at the time the protocol was written, spring high flows were the biologists were recommending against spring high flows because of a perceived impact on the trout and the chub. And you know, the fish aren't my area of expertise, but you know, the science there at the time was the spring high flows were stimulating the trout population, causing the trout population to increase, and too many trout was a bit of a threat to the chub because they might start preying on the chub or competing with the chub and cause the chub population to decline. And so spring high flows were, the idea was we should avoid those. And so it all fit together for this high flow protocol focused on the fall. The high flow protocol does allow for spring high flows, but it requires a sediment trigger in the spring, which are unlikely to occur. And so they haven't occurred. There hasn't been any sediment triggered spring high flows. And so there is some frustration now because, well, now the idea is that, well, maybe a spring high flow actually would be good for the biology. There's less concern about the trout-chub interaction, I think. But nevertheless, there's interest in spring high flows. But we're in this little bit of a trap where the protocol makes them happen in the fall. So there's some frustration with that in terms of how the system has worked and how the adaptive management program has worked. And there's some idea that, well, there should be some flexibility to adjust how that works to make a high flow more likely to occur in the spring. And I think that's probably going to happen, but you know, we're kind of working through that process. And so that, I mean, and that's another reason why, where the continued interaction and involvement is important, because these things, you know, the learning keeps changing a little bit and ideas evolve and we've got to adjust. Mm-hmm.
Are there good reasons that things take so much time? You're saying one of the frustrations is how long it took to get the high flow, the HFE protocol in place for an annual event. Should people interpret that as, you know, the typical problem of a bureaucracy, or can we, you know, shine a better light on that and say, well, that's how long it took us to do the groundwork and come to a consensus and know what we were doing was the right thing to do. What's your feeling about that? Is it just frustrating delays, or is there a good explanation for why it takes so long?
Oh, I think it's more towards the, I think there is a, in most cases, there's a decent explanation. Sometimes, you know, where that bridge, where that transition is from, you know, enough time to involve everybody so that everybody is involved in the decision process and gets to contribute versus something that just becomes bureaucratic delays. It's hard to know where the what the difference is there, but but it does take time. So I didn't consider the amount of time it took for that HFE protocol, which was a few years, made sense. I mean, that it was, you know, lots of discussions about how it was set up and including different parties in the process.
Can you think of, based on your experience over the years, can you think of any ways that we might improve the relationship between science and policy, get the results of research to be more useful and more effective in shaping policy decisions?
Well, I think, and I don't know how realistic it is. I mean, I think one of the things that has helped with this program is where you have a system set up or a structure where a group of both the decision makers and stakeholders interact with the scientists repeatedly over periods of many years. So you build up relationships and people build up some understanding of a system. And now, I mean, that works here where you have a big resource, a big dam, you know, Glen Canyon Dam, which is of interest to a lot of people, and the Grand Canyon National Park, which is a big focal point. I don't know how many different systems or problems this model can be successfully applied to, but I think that really does help, and I think applying that where to other problems would be useful. I mean, because I think that's a big part of what works is when you get people who are involved over long periods of time.
Climate change. How is climate change affecting the work that you do? Affecting the questions you ask? Affecting the decision-making environment of the adaptive management program?
Well, it's, you know, I'd say that it's something people have had in the back of their minds for a while, and I think in terms of actually impacting what we do, it's probably only just starting to creep in. I mean, certainly the issues of drought and the potential for longer periods of drought has been an issue that has that the water managers have been thinking about and are now doing more about. It does have a potential, certainly there's a lot of potential impacts on the resources in Grand Canyon and our program. I'm trying to think, I think we're in terms on the scientists here aren't studying climate change predictions per se so much, although recently there has been some of that, and I don't know if you've talked to anybody who's done that work, but there's been some work on temperature modeling throughout the Colorado River system, including Grand Canyon.
Who's doing that work?
That's where Jack Schmidt was involved in it, but Kim Dibble, who's in the building here, is the lead on it. Her Kim and Charles Yakulik.
D-I-B-B-L-E?
Yeah.
And Charles
Yakulik.
How do you spell that?
Y-A-C-K. I can spell, I can write it
down.
We'll
look it up. Send it to us later. Yeah, they might be interesting to interview then.
Yeah, and so they've looked at, you know, how climate change scenarios might affect river temperatures on the Colorado River Basin, which is hugely important.
Anybody looking at dam operations and climate change?
Exactly. No, that's part of the same question there, is both climate change and dam operations on river temperatures.
Okay.
And so the other thing that I'm looking at, not just for Grand Canyon, and almost more applied to the whole basin as a whole, is, you know, if river flows decline, what's the projected change on river channels? You know, we've seen, essentially we see channel narrowing as a result of dams because of a decrease in flood magnitudes, and we'd probably expect to see continued channel narrowing and channel simplification if peak flows and river flows continue to decline. So that's sort of the hypothesis on that. That's something that to be looking at. What else in the, you know, and then the big impact here is how managers decide to handle projections and the reality of climate change in managing the reservoirs of the basin. And that's sort of above our, outside our realm of study here, you know, how the managers decide whether they're going to keep, do everything they can to keep both Lake Mead and Lake Powell operational, or if one of them's going to go down first or what. How they decide to handle that issue will have a big impact. And so part of what we should be doing is, I guess, helping them think through what are the impacts of either of those decisions on the river system.
Yeah,
that's part of what this temperature study does, uh-huh. is helps them think about, just from the perspective of river temperatures, but we, in some sense, it's quite obvious what the different impacts would be, but we should be talking about that.
I'd say just 10 years ago, it was inconceivable that Glen Canyon Dam would not be operating far into the future. And we're at a situation now, just in the last few years, it's become increasingly obvious that there is a chance,
yeah.
that we may not be able to keep those two reservoirs functioning, and we may decide to go to a one reservoir river management regime at some point in the next 10 or 15 or 20 years if climate change, if this is the new normal. And it's a remarkable kind of new context for adaptive management and for the science that we need to do. It's,
yeah.
Everything could be topsy-turvy soon.
Yeah.
Everything changed.
Yeah.
big question, value of the adaptive management program and adaptive management as a management philosophy, a regime. Do you think it's valuable to approach things in this way?
Yeah, and as I said, from my perspective on how it's worked for the sediment resource, I think it's been worked pretty well. If your objective is to, you know, you have to, you know, we've got some pretty firm constraints on this system. I mean, we operate under, climate change could cause big changes in how the dams operate. But until that happens, we're operating under the system where the dam is there and it stays. It operates within its, you know, capacity, right? So even right now with reservoir levels low, they couldn't release more than about 40,000 cubic feet per second out of the dam, no matter how badly anybody wanted to, because the facility just can't do it. And they're very tied to the annual release volumes. So the system is pretty well boxed in terms of what they can actually do. And they've decided that within that, they're going to try and have this balance of resource, generation of electricity, you know, preservation of the native of aquatic species, of native fish, and maintenance of the river corridor system, the sandbars and the channel and the uplands, the archaeological sites. And they're trying to balance all those things. And if that is your objective, is to balance all those things, I think this framework works for that, because you get all the people with all their interests coming and sharing their perspectives and grievances, and you end up with something that is as much of a balance as there can be. you know, I think some people, you know, aside from a decision to shift balance in one direction or another, I think this kind of works for running that balance.
Great.
That's my perspective on it.
So you think it should be continued? It's been worthwhile?
I think so, yeah.
Is there anybody else that you haven't already mentioned that you think we should interview?
I don't know. I don't know who else. I don't. I'm not sure who else you have interviewed.
Yeah, I guess. It'd be easier if I share this with you.
I mean, I think from this, there's a lot of people who've been involved a long time. I mean, I don't know if you've talked to. Talk to Ted Mellis, who's been involved a long time.
We tried very hard to interview Ted, and he has not agreed yet. And if there's anything you can do to change his mind.
He's probably heard the whole thing. Let's see. And, you know, Carol Fritzinger might be a good person to interview.
She's not on our list. Carol Fritzinger?
Yeah, she's our retired logistics coordinator. So she's retired from the USGS. So she, I mean, I don't, I feel like I've spoken quite freely, but she's fully released from federal service, so she can say whatever she wants.
And she worked
and
for
she will.
GCMRC.
She did, yeah, up until she just retired in January this year. You know, at the beginning of this year.
Okay.
What was it? Did she retire last year? Gosh, it's been time goes by. So Fritz is retired. I mean, is there any particular area that you feel like you've, I mean, you probably talked to Jack, I imagine.
Jack Schmidt, yes, definitely. And Dave Wagner, all the real old timers.
Bob Webb?
No.
You talked to Bob Webb? I wonder what he would have to say.
Who's Bob Webb?
He's in Tucson.
Oh, good. So's Dave Wagner.
And
he was GCMRC?
He's USGS, kind of a USGS sort of national research program.
Type, retired, right?
And retired. But he worked on the tributaries, on debris flows, and so not so much the sandbars, but on flash floods from tributaries.
Okay.
He did a lot of reef photography.
Oh,
so you should check out some of his publications on reef. I don't know if he did a whole book on the Stanton expedition.
Oh, that's where I saw the name.
Yeah,
I have seen his
and
work.
And so,
okay, that's
you know, great. On the science side, David Rubin, who did a lot of the early sediment work, and you could talk and David Topping, who's in our office here.
David Rubin and David Topping.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, and Scott Vanderkooy, we should try to get right.
Yeah, and I suppose.
No, that's a good list.
Everybody.
It's an excellent list.
I mean, I'm sure there are a lot depending on everybody probably would.
Everybody would what?
I don't know. There's probably lots of people that you could talk to.
All right. Okay, anything, any last thoughts you'd like to share before we turn it off?
Let's see. Well, yeah, I think we've covered, I mean, I think it's been a great, it's been a great privilege for me to be able to work here and to be able to do this and be involved in both sides, this aspect of being able to do some basic research, but also do applied research that has a direct management focus. You know, not every scientist gets to, I mean, you know, scientists can do what they want, but not everyone gets to be doing something that other people really care about or are, you know, actually doing something with what you're doing on a, you know, implementing it or making decisions based on what you do. So that's, I think that's a great, you know, opportunity and privilege for those of us working here.
Great, so. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay.